WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. With several lobbying scandals in play, we thought this was a good time to take a look at how lobbying works and the increasing power lobbyists have in the writing of legislation. Last week, we focused on the investigations into lobbyists Jack Abramoff and Michael Scanlon. Today, we're going to talk with someone whose job is monitoring lobby groups. Alex Knott is the Lobby Watch project manager for the Center for Public Integrity. Knott was also the project manager for the Center for Public Integrity's investigative book, The Buying of the President, 2004. Do you have an example or a story, you know, that crystallizes how lobbying works and why you think it sometimes goes too far?
Well, there was a situation where a former Florida senator named Connie Mack put forward a legislation that would help out Bacardi on some trademark issues that it was having with Cuba. And the bill was put forward and was passed, and it was a special section, just a small, short section, that was put forth and written by Bacardi. Well, this legislation was passed, and Connie Mack, when he retired, he went to go work for, you guessed it, Bacardi, working on this to keep the legislation that he passed into law to continue to be the law so that Bacardi would be helped on that legislation. So it's a funny situation where sometimes members of Congress will take an action which later gets rewarded when they move to K Street.
It sounds like lobbyists are influencing legislators in almost unprecedented ways. Some people are saying that lobbyists are almost writing the bills with the legislators. What have you learned about new ways that lobbyists are influencing legislation?
Well, a lot of times they will write legislation. Sometimes they just write an amendment, which will get slipped in during a committee markup. It will only be a few sentences to a bill, but sometimes it can have a massive effects, either in regulation, which will save an industry billions of dollars, or sometimes contracts, which will be handed out through a sole source, no bid situation that will help a company directly. For a long period of time, there has been a lot of lobbyists that have played a role in formulating legislation, but these days they are writing it directly. Not every piece of legislation that's put out there, but there were 7,000 bills between the House and the Senate during the last congressional session, and many of those are written by lobbyists, largely.
The Center did a year-long study on global pharmaceutical corporations. And concluded that pharmaceutical corporations spent more than $800 million in federal lobbying and campaign donations in the past 7 years. What impact did the pharmaceutical lobby have on the Medicare prescription drug benefit?
Well, there were a couple bills that were being put forth. The Democrats wanted lower prices and things that would require more regulation of the pharmaceutical industry. And the Republican-sponsored bill was a little bit more industry-friendly. And this ended up being the bill that passed. It was actually the president's initiative, and it was the president's prescription Medicare drug plan. This was the one that ended up passing, and everybody from pharmaceutical companies to the American Medical Association to the AARP weighed in on this. And at the end of the day, the pharmaceutical companies got at least a closer version of the legislation that they wanted, and it helped them out.
What did they want, and how did they get it?
There were many things that they wanted. One of the biggest things is that they wanted patent extensions, and this was part of the bill. Another thing that they wanted was making sure that no drugs came in through the exportation from Canada. This was another part of the bill. But instead of making the pharmaceuticals lose part of their profits, what happened is largely the federal government picked up the tab for this, and it saved the pharmaceutical companies from both regulation and loss in profits.
I don't know if this is a question that you can actually answer, but how much do you think the pharmaceutical lobby was behind, was the inspiration for the Medicare prescription drug bill?
Well, there's a lot of situations where they list lobbying the bill very early in the session. So one would believe that people from the pharmaceutical industry had a direct role with its inception. You know, there are a lot of groups, pharmaceutical companies being some of them, that lobby the White House directly. For instance, the Biotechnology Industry Organization, rather, which represents many pharmaceutical makers, has been one of, they're the 13th largest group that has lobbied the White House directly. So many of the things that come out in the president's proposals are lobbied on directly by industries, and then they take the form of legislation or an initiative. Sometimes it could be even something that could be an executive order that's put forth, like the Healthy Forest Initiative was originally an executive order until it passed as an act. So there are many little things like this that are, you know, that are lobbied by lobbyists that, that come into the White House and come in and out, and sometimes even buy trips for people that work as staffers.
Do you have any idea of what the pharmaceutical lobby did to influence legislators who were voting on the Medicare prescription drug plan?
Well, sure. They hired a lot of well-connected people. I don't have these figures directly in front of me. However, a lot of times they'll hire people that have revolving door links to members of Congress. Revolving doors, you know, something that's understood inside the Beltway, but to explain it, there are about 10,000 people that work for members of Congress as staffers. And then, of course, you have members of Congress, and then a huge amount of people that also work for the federal government. We have found that there have been 2,200 people that have registered as lobbyists that have worked for the government prior. And a lot of times they'll have a connection to a member of Congress who's going to vote on one of these bills or amend or support some of this legislation. So by hiring some of the friends and the people that are well-connected to members of Congress that are going to weigh in on this legislation, they are often able to change the votes and shift the focus and shift the debate on legislation like the Prescription Drug Act. So using revolving doors and hiring lobbyists that are very well-connected can be the most succinct way of changing how things are viewed by Congress.
So you're hiring people who have access to the people who are voting.
That's exactly it. Some of the friends and former colleagues, we found that there are 236 former members of Congress that have registered since 1998, and they can walk onto the House and Senate floor and discuss things with members of Congress. Now, they're not supposed to lobby them directly there or in the cloakrooms or in the Speaker's lobby or in the President's room, but these facilities that basically only members of Congress can go to and former members of Congress that are now lobbyists are really exclusive, and this is a situation where former members can have an extraordinary power to influence a lawmaker's views.
Now, I want to get back to something we were talking about a moment ago, which is that some bills are virtually written, or some amendments within bills are virtually written by lobbyists. I don't really understand how that works. If you're a legislator, do you just say to a lobbyist, hey, you write this for me, and I'll just put it in? I mean, how do lobbyists get to actually write parts of bills?
Well, a lot of times a member of Congress will weigh in with an industry to at least understand their perspective before going forward and proposing and writing legislation, and which is a good value judgment. You kind of want to know how things are going to affect teachers, so you might want to talk to a teacher group and just talk to them and understand that. And that's something that takes place with some types of lobbying. However, a lot of times lobbying groups will just put forward legislation, and they'll find a member of Congress who often values their judgment so much so that they basically submit almost all of the language, and it'll get written up by their legislative writers, you know, over at Ford in the House or corresponding buildings in the Senate, and then the legislation will come forward, and you won't even see the lobbyist's fingerprints on it by the end of the day. You won't know who put forward this bill.
Is it hard to establish a direct quid pro quo between a lobbyist and a legislator?
It's very hard. One of the reasons that it's hard to get these quid pro quos and really prove them is because lobbyists' disclosure is pretty weak. You only have to submit every 6 months. And if I started lobbying on something in, let's say, January, you wouldn't find out about it until mid-October, probably at the earliest, just because you only have to file every 6 months, and it takes a while for those records to get in the system. By then, the legislation could have been passed already, and it's no longer newsworthy, so the press doesn't have any reason to necessarily cover who's lobbying on a certain issue, and they don't have any way to really track it in any real time. There's a few bills in the House that are looking at this currently, and they're trying to increase the filing requirements, make them happen quarterly instead of semi-annually, and also to try to make it electronically filed, which is something that is being considered, though we're not advocating anything on either way on that.
My guest is Alex Knott. He runs the Lobby Watch Project at the Center for Public Integrity. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Alex Knott. He's the Lobby Watch Project Manager for the Center for Public Integrity in Washington, D.C. Let's talk about the K Street Project. From what I've read, it's my understanding that this is an initiative to make sure that lobby groups are staffed largely or exclusively by Republicans and to basically get rid of Democrats in lobby groups. What's your understanding of the K Street Project?
Well, basically, this is an initiative that's been put forward by former House Majority Leader Tom DeLay and Rick Santorum and GOP strategist Grover Norquist. And the idea is basically that different lobbying firms on K Street and otherwise hire as many Republicans as possible and almost exclude Democrats from the process. Basically, now, since the Republicans have control of the White House, the Senate, and the House, there's almost one more house that could be taken, and that would be the lobbying house, basically K Street.
An article in the Washington Monthly said the lobbies have become a Republican political machine. Does that sound accurate to you?
To a certain extent, it is, and there's a reason that there is so much pressure to make these groups Republican. A lot of times when a member of Congress wants to retire, they want to get a very lucrative job on K Street. Sometimes just being a member of Congress is a resume builder for an ultimately much more lucrative job on K Street, such as members of Congress only receive about $160,000, and it's difficult to say only attached to that, but you can make, you know, well over $1 million being a former member of Congress who lobbies. So this can really set them up. And not only that can it set them up, but it can set up their staffs. You know, there's nearly 10,000 people that work on the Hill. And Republicans want other Republicans to staff those positions on K Street.
Does the K Street Project represent a new direction in lobbying? I mean, for example, in the classic relationship between lobbyist and legislator, the lobbyist wants a certain legislation passed that will help their industry, and in return, they might give some kind of favor to the legislator. But what the K Street Project is doing is they're pushing at the lobbyists to do political things, to have a political direction. Does that represent something new?
I think it does, in that it's so organically partisan. You know, lobbyists have always been in the business of providing favors to members of Congress. Many times these favors take the form of a trip or possibly a campaign contribution. But actually formulating staffs that would behoove a lawmaker, well, that's kind of a new thing. At least it's the first time it's ever happened on such a massive scale as with the K Street Project. I'm sure that, you know, there have been situations in the past where certain lobbying firms are very business friendly or more Republican based or more labor union friendly / Democratic based. But on a whole scale market, when you look at the lobbying industry, and that's really what it is, it's an industry, to see something this massive and on this scale, this is kind of a new thing. This is a situation where they're actually actively going out and changing their hiring practices to only hire Republicans, many times hiring Republicans that were former staff members of the people that they are trying to influence. So it actually somewhat behooves them, because now they can hire a lobbyist who is going to be able to go to that former member and have this working relationship with them. But it also helps them out because they're doing a favor for these members of Congress, which is, you know, tantamount to any campaign contribution. It's also equal to any large favor, like a trip.
Jack Abramoff and Michael Scanlon are involved in a big lobbying scandal right now involving their work on behalf of Indian tribes who run or want to run casinos. What would you say have been their trademarks as lobbyists? Like, what sets them apart from what other lobbyists have done?
Well, I think the number one thing is the dollars that they charged for their services. The amount of money that they charged these Indian tribes were completely out of character for lobbying. They were so high that many people on K Street laughed at how much they were receiving. You know, I've even spoke to a former member of Congress who is a lobbyist now, and they've dealt with some of their clients. And they just were blown away by how much Mr. Abramoff was charging their clients. It was just amazing. And even many of the people that are on K Street were kind of ready for, you know, an indictment to take place, because it was kind of giving the rest of the lobbyists, believe it or not, a bad name.
They've been indicted for defrauding the Indian tribes that they represented. Do you see what they've done as just being greedy, or do you see it as part of a larger direction that lobbying has headed in?
Well, lobbying is it is a direction that lobbying is headed in. Lobbying has increased over the years to a large amount. In 1998, $1.4 billion was spent lobbying the federal government. During 2004, $2.1 billion was spent lobbying the federal government. Right now, lobbying's unregulated, and you can charge as much as you want to lobby on behalf of somebody. And it's kind of a free agency situation where if you feel that you deserve a certain rate, you can ask for it. And if as long as the corporation is willing to pay for it, you can get the money and then lobby. It's a new ground. Companies have realized that lobbying equates to less than pennies on the dollar, whether it's a new initiative that could be environmental, that could cost energy companies billions of dollars, or whether it's a situation where pharmaceuticals have less regulation, or even another situation where large defense contractors can receive, you know, billions of dollars in contracts by only spending millions of dollars lobbying.
You know, in the relationship between lobbyists and legislators, how much do you think that lobbyists are just relying on their powers of persuasion? They're experts in the field. They know what their industry wants. And how much of it is actually like buying favor?
Well, a large amount of it is buying favor. We found that there are a lot of lawmakers that that have put lobbyists in charge of their campaign committees and leadership PACs. For instance, you know, there's almost 80 members of Congress who have appointed lobbyists to be the treasurers of their campaign committees. And basically, since they control the purse strings of their reelection, they have this overwhelming favor from that member of Congress. It goes way beyond any campaign contribution if you control a member of Congress's campaign committee. And that's something that's happened over and over on Capitol Hill, between K Street and Capitol Hill. But sometimes a lobbyist's best friend is the information that they carry. A lot of times the lobbyist knows the most about this bill, many times because they wrote it, you know, because there's so many bills, because these bills are hundreds to thousands of pages long. Members of Congress rely upon lobbyists more and more to get their opinions so that they can comprehensively understand what's in these bills. The only thing is while these lobbyists are, you know, informing these members of Congress, they are often twisting the facts to benefit their industry.
Senator McCain said on our show this week that he plans to introduce legislation to further regulate lobby groups. What kind of regulation of lobby groups would you like to see?
Well, while the Center for Public Integrity doesn't advocate anything, I think that a lot of campaign finance and lobbying reform advocates would like to see more transparency to the system. Something that happens semi-annually, it is not a real-time situation where a democracy can have an understanding of who's affecting their democracy. They probably would want a longer cooling-off period so that so many of these proverbial revolving doors that you hear about wouldn't take place immediately and kind of negate many of the conflicts of interest that take place. I think a lot of people are looking to stem the tide of trips that are being paid for members of Congress so that situations where Jack Abramoff is paying for a member of Congress to go play golf in Scotland wouldn't exist anymore. And also, you would probably see a lot more situations where the forms would be more transparent so that you could actually see more or less what legislation is actually being affected by the lobbyists as it was being affected.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Alex Knott runs the Lobby Watch Project at the Center for Public Integrity. I have a correction to make. On Tuesday, during my interview with Senator John McCain, while we were discussing how current ethics, bribery, and corruption investigations are affecting the Republican Party, I mentioned the name of Congressman Bob Ney. I mistakenly said that the congressman had resigned. He has not. Congressman Ney is still in office and is running for re-election. I regret the error. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.